The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is an atmospheric scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist who was observing the growth of CO2 emissions and changes in Earth climate firsthand when he decided to make personal changes in his own life and the life of his family to lessen his carbon footprint. He began by bicycling, eventually growing his own food, and other simple changes. He also credits meditation for playing a role in changing the way he consumed. And through these changes, he reduced his carbon consumption from 19 tons a year, the U.S. average, to about 1 ton, a 90% reduction. His book, Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, has a twofold purpose. Part one lays out the science of climate change in a very readable style, as well as some of the factors behind it, like growth economics, overpopulation, and industrial agriculture. The second part lays out his own solution, his ways of reducing his family's carbon output, and how for him it made his life not one of privation, but one of greater happiness. Being the Change is now the focus of a new feature documentary as well. I mentioned Kalmus is a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but he's speaking on his own behalf today as our guest on Studio Tulsa. We also want to apologize for some of the sound quality in today's interview. Peter Kalmus, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
In your new book, Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, you talk about how you managed to reduce your carbon footprint down to a tenth. What went into that decision to sort of say, okay, personally, I'm going to see how much I can reduce, how much fossil fuel I use in the course of my daily life?
So the main thing was that the connection between burning fossil fuels and climate disruption was getting more and more clear to me, to the point where it just seems a little crazy to me that it's still socially acceptable to burn fossil fuels the way it is right now. So I guess maybe I'm a little bit on the vanguard as an earth scientist. I can see the changes that are happening in the earth system, kind of got front row seats there. But the connection is so clear that it just started to feel less and less good to me to burn fossil fuels. And so it became kind of a challenge. I said, you know, what can I do to, here's something that is emitting CO2 that I do. How can I change that? How can I reduce it? And so it sort of became this kind of fun game that required some creativity and, you know, a little bit of thoughtfulness.
In the beginning of your book, you lay out the case for climate change and how fossil fuels and CO2 buildup is contributing to our climate change and warming of the globe. And one of the things you at the very beginning of the book, you sort of talk about how we've got these buzzwords like sustainable and green. It says, really, these don't really say much. It says, really, what we need to be thinking about is low energy. What do you mean by low energy?
So low energy just means using less energy overall. The way I see the kind of renewable energy revolution is that maybe we need to meet it halfway as a society and absolutely switch away from fossil fuels and switch toward renewable energy, but at the same time, maybe consider just using less. One great example of that is flying in airplanes. There's currently no renewable alternatives to commercial aviation. So, you know, we might have to rethink fast travel and maybe start traveling a little bit more slowly, which uses less energy.
Now, in the book, you say, you know, if you really do have to go across country, you're taking the train as much as possible?
Yeah, so my wife and I, we live in Los Angeles, and we have parents that live in Illinois, and we see them about once a year. So we either take the train or else we drive. And when we drive, we often do it in a car that I converted to run on waste vegetable oil, which was just kind of a fun thing that I did back, you know, in 2010, around then, before electric cars were quite as good as they are now. Now they've gotten far more affordable, and their range has improved, and they're getting fast charge options. So, you know, I think in the coming years, it'll be quite possible to do a 2,000-mile trip like that in an electric car.
It was interesting. I was traveling across the country by car this last week, and I was surprised to see when I was stopping in, say, the middle of nowhere in western Kansas, there was a charging station for one of the major electric car brands. right off the interstate. So how soon do you think we'll have a network like that for electric recharging?
You know, I really can't say. I'm not really up to speed that much on electric cars. I think they're great. One concern about, transition to rooftop solar and electric cars that I have is that I have a lot of friends who are, really interested in becoming more green, as they say. But I think sometimes they do those changes, get rooftop solar, get an electric car, and they feel like they've done their part. In the book, I'm kind of urging people to go a little bit more deeply into this and to really examine one's mindset and really examine how, how do you interact with the food system, for example? How do you interact with decisions about where you live relative to your job and so forth? How do you connect with your community? How can you make some of these changes and share them with your community? So to me, global warming is such an urgent thing. Absolutely, any changes we make are changes in the right direction. But once we've made these changes, I think we should be asking ourselves, what can we do to go further?
It was interesting you said, that's sort of a one step, switching to, say, a renewable energy car or using electric power, which still has to be generated. You have a little thing about recycling in there as well, about how a lot of people think, okay, I'm doing my bit through recycling. But to me, recycling it's maybe step 88 out of 100, as far as trying to bring CO2 levels, because everything we recycle, even though it is recycled, we don't know how it's recycled necessarily. We don't know where that waste goes once it is recycled, how much energy is being used to move that waste to a recycling location, which sometimes is halfway around the world. What are your thoughts on that recycling bit?
I refer, I think, to recycling as garbage 2.0. It's out of sight, out of mind. I think it's, it's not a bad thing in and of itself, of course, but it's something that, allows us to assuage guilt and allows us to continue living exactly as we've lived before without much further examination. So, I feel like this is maybe one of the problems with the environmental movement over the last few decades. I think it's been a little bit afraid to ask too much of us. And it's also kind of relied on sort of guilt to motivate us. And I think both of those things are kind of wrong. I think there's a lot of people out there concerned about global warming who are ready to do more and are hungry for information on how to do that and maybe a little bit of inspiration. And once a few of us start doing more as individuals, my hope is that it'll start making that look a little bit more normal to our friends and to our neighbors. I think global warming is largely just a huge failure of imagination. We tend to go about our daily lives, and if we see everyone flying around, putting gas in their cars, we're so inundated with images of fossil fuel use, and we're so inundated with fossil fuel infrastructure that it can be a little bit hard to imagine living without it. I mean, what does that actually look like? So if a few of us start actually showing that and telling that new story, I think that's incredibly helpful for the culture at large to start imagining what it is really going to look like. And the key message that I found and that a lot of people are finding who are doing this is that it can actually make your life more satisfying to live with less fossil fuels, not less satisfying.
Now, we'll get into that in just a second. I want to recommend your book because you spend quite a bit of the time making the case for where we are on our climate change and in the CO2 emissions and methane emissions and nitrous oxide emissions and all the emissions which are contributing to a larger greenhouse effect on the planet and what's that doing to temperatures. And it's really fairly concise. It is a bit scientific, but I have to admit it really lays out that case. A lot of people look at that and they just say, oh my gosh, what can we do? Where do I start in trying to reduce your own fossil fuel footprint? What was the first step for you?
The first thing I did was just kind of figured out how my daily actions were connecting quantitatively to my CO2 emissions, because I didn't know. And there's online calculators, but somehow they didn't, at the time at least, this was in 2010, there may be some better ones now, but it was kind of like going through a questionnaire and it asked me a bunch of questions and it gave me this report. And I didn't get the sense like, all right, so if I drive my kids to school, how much CO2 is that? If I eat meat, how much CO2 is that? So I just sat down, did some research, figured out how much flying contributed, how much my diet contributed, driving, natural gas, electricity, and so forth, buying stuff. Did my best to estimate that based on some scientific papers that were out there and some other research sources. And then to my surprise, this was all kind of in one evening that I just sat down, like, got to figure this out. For me, in 2010, flying was about three-quarters of my greenhouse gas emissions. And my second biggest source of emissions was my diet. You know, at the time, I was still eating meat and had probably a pretty typical American diet. And so those were two big surprises that I wouldn't have known if I hadn't actually run the numbers and figured out that quantitative connection.
So where was the first place you started?
So even before I sat down and did that, you know, I was, like I said, I was starting to feel like I just didn't want to burn fossil fuels anymore. The first thing I did was I started riding a bike, and I loved it. At the time, I had a six-mile commute each way to Caltech, and I'd been riding a motorcycle on that commute, and it was actually a pretty gas-guzzling motorcycle. and I finally just said, why don't I just ride a bike? And so, you know, the first time I got on the bike, it was sort of a revelation. It was felt a little bit wobbly, but, you know, all kinds of memories came back from, you know, being a kid, from this long bike ride I took from home from Denver to my parents' house in Chicago after a summer job when I was younger. I saw the neighborhoods I was going through in a new way, got to kind of like make some friends along the way that I would see every day. And I just started getting healthier. I felt happy when I was on the bike. These were all surprises. You know, I did it because I didn't want to ride that motorcycle anymore. But all of these positive sort of auxiliary secondary effects came that I hadn't expected. Then after I made that quantitative connection, I actually made a pie chart. Then I decided I have to ramp down my flying. That took me a couple of years. Even before I made that pie chart, I've been thinking, you know, I kind of want to experiment with vegetarianism. And so that made me say, well, what am I waiting for? I'm going to give it a try. And I ended up actually liking that better too, again, to my surprise.
How did you replace flying? As you're an atmospheric scientist, I assume you're going back and forth between various coasts for, you know, scientific conferences or for just a part of your work at NASA. How did you replace flying? Was it taking a train?
I would just carpool with colleagues. I did take the train once. There was one time that I combined a trip to my parents' house in Illinois with a trip to my sister's house in Massachusetts, which was the first time I'd seen her place there, and then a conference, a really nice conference in Maine. But that was, I kind of decided that was a little bit too far to drive. So, yeah, it's tough. You know, my scientific networking is probably not quite as fast as it otherwise would be if I were flying. But I try to do good work, write some good papers, you know, meet with people when they come to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory here, and go to as many regional conferences as I can. I actually have a new website called noflyclimatesci.org, which has anecdotes from other climate scientists and other academics who are trying to fly less, and some have, like me, have eliminated their flying. So we're trying to push for more teleconferencing technology and to make that kind of a more normal part of conferencing.
Now, your book actually sort of determines the CO2 per passenger. And you mentioned riding Amtrak emits about 0.14 kilograms CO2 per passenger mile. But it said even if you could take a bus, it would drop it down to 0.07 kilograms. But again, the trade-off is time. You know how American business is, and even your work in government. It's like you don't have that time to take 2 or 3 days to go across country.
Right. Well, I actually, as a scientist, I really relish the train rides because for some reason there's internet on buses, but there is no internet on trains. But I see that as an advantage because, you know, I'll get a, you know, maybe 10 papers that I've been meaning to read over the last few months, and I'll finally sit down and read them. Sometimes I work on my own papers, and it's amazing how much I can get done in that context, with no internet and just with that determination before I go to get a lot of work done. So that's very productive time for me on the train. The other thing is the train has so much unrealized potential in this country that the routes that I take are usually on freight line. They're sharing tracks with freight trains, and the Amtrak train is lesser priority. So once we get a little bit late, then the lateness starts to pile up. Plus, we have to go pretty slow most of the way. I think with a sort of a mindful train policy in this country, we could probably easily cut those train times in half, which would help a lot.
My guest today is Peter Kalmus. He is an atmospheric scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who I should note is speaking on his own behalf, and he's the author of Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you mentioned, when you created this sort of sets of actions to reduce your emissions, you mentioned quitting planes was by far the biggest annual reductionism. Freeganism. I hadn't heard this term before. What is freeganism?
Well, you know, basically dumpster diving. That's how I started out. I had some friends who were doing that here in Los Angeles, and I'm like, wow, that sounds kind of fun. So I tried it with them. They showed me the ropes, and it was really fun. And then really quickly, you know, I there's so much bread getting thrown away, for a lot of bread, a lot of eggs. You could basically live off of French toast forever out of the dumpsters in this country. So, one time we got a bunch of bread, and on the way back, I stopped at a local homeless shelter and said, "You guys want this bread?" They said, "No, we already have too much bread." And so I was stuck with all this bread. And we have this backyard produce exchange here in Altadena. You know, people who grow food. A lot of us have trees, and when the tree is producing fruit, it's like way too much for our family. So we share it with this group, and then other people come bring other produce, and we kind of exchange it that way. So I emailed that group, and, you know, within a few hours, all the bread was taken. And then one person in the group said, "Hey, you know, want to help me? I've got this relationship with a local supermarket where they actually give us the spoils, you know, and you don't actually have to go in a dumpster." So I do that every 2 weeks and get the majority of the food for my family, which is great because, you know, it's 40% of food in this country is wasted, which is pretty shocking. And it feels really good to keep some of that, to dip into that waste stream and keep some of it from going into the landfill, where it basically turns into methane, which, you know, as you know, is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2.
And in fact, when you were looking at the annual reduction, that was the second biggest area, even beyond, a lot of other things you would think more.
Yeah. Well, so when you add the amount of greenhouse gases that's used to produce the food, and you include, you know, add that to the amount of waste that is made when the wasted food goes into the landfill and turns into methane, then yeah, that's actually pretty significant. And, you know, saves me money too. I should say that a lot of the stuff that I do it's a little bit alternative to the kind of the mainstream, you know, like I said, solar panels and electric car, because pretty much everything I do saves me a lot of money. We wanted to put solar panels on our roof, but we were already using so little electricity that it made no sense. But, you know, the solar leasing company said, "We don't have any systems that small." And it would have taken like, you know, 30 or 35 years just to pay back the system if we purchased it. So instead, right around that same time, the local utility finally offered a 100% renewable option. So that cost us like an extra $50 a year or something. So we did that instead of putting panels on our rooftop.
And that's sort of a carbon offset in a way, because it's, your power still may be coming from natural gas or whatever, but it's, that amount of energy is going into the mix from renewables.
Right. So obviously, you know, it's not, once the electrons are produced by, you know, a solar panel or by natural gas, they all go into the same system. But you're basically telling the utility, you're kind of voting with your dollars for them to put more renewables into the mix. You know, another interesting thing in that regard is something called community choice aggregation, which is, a handful of states have it so far, maybe 8 states, and one of them is California. This is a way for cities and counties to team up and say, there's a law that says the utility has to carry the electricity through the lines, but the groups of counties and cities can decide how they want to generate it. So they can do, like, local projects, put solar, you know, mid-sized solar plants over big parking lots and stuff like that. It creates local jobs, and they can decide as a group of communities how they want to do that, how they want to do net metering, whether they want to support and push for rooftop solar and so on. So that's a great thing, and I hope that spreads to more places.
You know, what I was sort of surprised about was how, you know, we think of our cars as being one of the biggest contributors to CO2, just as a way, you know, of reducing car trips as a way of reducing CO2. It does reduce it, but not by as much as you would think. You use bicycling. You also drive on waste vegetable oil, and that's an interesting story. I mean, that was one of the first steps you took beyond bicycling was, okay, let's convert this car to run on waste vegetable oil. Is that still a net saver?
Well, it is. You know, and when you're thinking about cars, remember that a new car, just to create that car, to make the steel and to make the glass and to assemble it, to ship all the parts, that's an incredible amount of emissions just embodied in the car itself. So by taking a 1984 car and kind of keeping it running and doing the work on it myself, you know, and that's also kind of preventing me from, you know, buying a new car. In Los Angeles with kids, it's pretty hard to, possible, but it's pretty hard to live without a car right now. You know, I hope that changes in the future. Another thing I like about the veggie oil car is I got to make the fuel myself. I collect old waste veggie oil from a local sushi restaurant. Then I got to filter it. But these 5-gallon jugs, they weigh like 40 pounds each. So there's a lot of listing of fuel. And it's like I see the fuel is really precious because it's something that I'm getting myself. So I don't take it for granted. I'm very aware of how much stuff it is. You know, when we fill up our cars or when we go on a plane, it's an incredible amount of fuel just in terms of the mass. And then even more carbon dioxide is emitted, and we can't see that. So very much out of sight, out of mind. And by lugging around these big cubes of veggie oil, I'm very aware, like, wow, this is just a lot of stuff that we're burning and putting in the atmosphere.
Hmm. My guest today is Peter Kalmus. He is the author of Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. Due to the changes he's made in his life, he and his wife and family live on a tenth of the fossil fuels of average American. And it's an interesting list of things. I mean, some are something that all of us can do rather simply. Now, it doesn't make a huge effect, but I think it all adds up. Everything from lowering your pilot lights, turning off lights. What are some of the other small things that anybody can do without really too much work?
Well, so if you have a little space, you can grow a little bit of food. That helps also. You know, to me, that was another one of those surprises where, wow, this is something I love doing. I had no idea I would enjoy gardening so much. If you have a little bit of space, you can make a compost pile. That way, the food waste and organic waste breaks down into CO2 aerobically instead of breaking down into methane anaerobically in the landfill. So that's a bit of a savings. And also a way of, again, of connecting yourself.
Now, how does that make a big difference? Aerobically, it breaks down to CO2 instead of methane.
Right. So because oxygen is available, there's a pathway to create CO2, which of course has oxygen. So there's one carbon atom in a CO2 molecule, and there's one carbon atom in a molecule of methane, which of course doesn't have any oxygen. But methane is a more potent greenhouse gas. So that one molecule of methane is going to heat up the planet quite a bit more than one molecule of carbon dioxide. And then after some time, after 10 or 20 years, that molecule of methane is going to convert into CO2 and stay in the atmosphere for thousands of years, just like the CO2. But it's got that initial early stage of being methane and trapping more infrared radiation as a methane molecule.
What was one of the more difficult decisions you made as far as something that you know, I'm not sure I'm up for this, and then you found that it worked or it didn't work?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, probably the most difficult thing, the thing that kind of changed the architecture of my life the most was not flying anymore. And I think that's true of a lot of people that come up to me after I give talks. A lot of us have flying as a big part of our lives, and flying connects us to loved ones. Travel is amazing. I've done a lot of traveling in my life. Whether you're flying or doing slow travel is just amazing, the way it broadens your horizon and kind of allows you to sort of take stock of your life. So, yeah, to not fly was a bit tough. You know, it slowed down my career a little bit. But, you know, there was a point back, it was like 2012, and I was sitting on a plane going to a conference, and I was just thinking about my kids and, you know, giving this update on my research, and I just didn't feel like I belonged on that plane. I didn't want to be there. I So I said, you know, I just can't do this anymore. You know, I'd also gotten kind of tired of that sort of business travel for science, for going to conferences and staying in hotels, the jet lag. I would always get sick when I got back home. Maybe I caught something on the plane, or maybe I hadn't gotten enough sleep. So I was at the point where I was getting a little tired of that in any case.
Well, let me ask you one. You've alluded to this a couple of times. You know, you lay out the case that our climate is changing. It's changing quickly compared to other points of climate change, and you lay out your evidence in the book. But a lot of times when people are faced, even if they, you know, among skeptics and the like, sometimes they'll admit it, but they'll say the cost of adapting is going to be so high that they just can't see how the U.S. economy can do it.
Right.
One of the things I think your book sort of points out is the benefits. It will stimulate the economy. That's spending.
Yeah, I think that that's I don't think that that argument holds water, and I think that that's it's becoming more and more clear that that argument doesn't hold water. I mean, we're having increasing frequency of natural disasters. The projections for, you know, the kind of flooding we could see along our coast and the you know, the destruction and the relocation, the cost of that is, it's hard to estimate, but, you know, man, the insurance companies sure would, I think, disagree with that argument that it's more costly to do something to transition away from fossil fuels than to actually deal with the breakdown and disasters that are impending on the horizon. You know, the other thing is other countries, China comes to mind, even India is starting to transition. The future of the world economy, the future of national economies on this planet, is to transition away from fossil fuels. And the countries that start doing that sooner are going to have a head start, and the countries that wait are going to be behind, and they're going to lose out on job creation, on economic growth. And then, you know, I think it's a huge opportunity that we're missing. And the last thing I'll say is there are ways to put a price on carbon emissions to make it more expensive to use fossil fuels, and then, of course, relatively cheaper to use alternatives, that could actually stimulate the economy. The key thing that stimulates the economy is if you collect that rising price on carbon emissions, so that carbon fee, which goes up year after year, if you return 100% of that to the people in an equal dividend, then that can actually, there's lots of studies now that show that can stimulate economic growth.
Hmm. Peter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Peter Kalmus is an atmospheric scientist and the author of Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. It's published by New Society. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.